Welcome to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. KPFT is your community-supported Pacifica radio station. I'm Mike Koenig. This is Think Wing Radio. My compadre on engineering is Egberto Willis. He has his own show Thursdays at 3 called Politics Done Right. Here we do politics okay and occasionally not at all. This is Open Forum. Phone number is 713-526-5738. And I actually have a topic that falls into the politics pretty much not at all. It's actually a couple of things. One of the things that I thought I would bring up, because it's interesting, I'm kind of an old movie guy. What's interesting is even though I like movies, and even though I like old movies, there are some old movies that I like should see. I know I should see them. They're like what they call on TCM the essentials, Turner Classic Movies, the essentials, movies that you should know. One of those is a movie called Gentleman's Agreement with Gregory Peck. It's basically a movie about anti-Semitism. It was an important topic when it was made in 1947 because World War II was still fresh in memory. Germany and Japan were still occupied. The Holocaust was still something new in human memory, not just in history. And that made the topic of anti-Semitism in the United States, having just fought a war where anti-Semitism resulted in the deaths of millions and millions of people, not just Jews, it was very timely. Now, the reason I bring it up is because having watched the film just last night for the first time since 1947, it occurred to me that while the movie is about anti-Semitism in America, it could be viewed today in a much broader context. It doesn't have to be seen specifically as a movie about anti-Semitism. It can be a movie about discrimination against any minority. And depending on where you are in time and place, it could be a movie about discrimination against Irish or Catholics or blacks or Muslims or Arabs, who are not necessarily Muslim, by the way. And for that reason, I think it's worth watching. You know, it falls into the category of something I once wrote for my blog, which is thinkwingradio.com, things you can learn from an old movie. It's got a great cast. It's not an action picture by any terms. It's definitely a cerebral film. But it talks a lot about not only hidden racism, but passive racism, which is to say that you're, even if you don't consider yourself a racist, even if you are not a racist, when you're passive about other people's racism, you are enabling it. So if someone tells a joke, and this is a specific example that's discussed in the movie, if someone tells a joke that you find repulsive, you feel revulsion toward the person, toward the derogatory words that they used, just about the fact that they think this joke is funny, that's an enabling activity. If you say nothing, if you do nothing, you are enabling it. So I would mention that if you have the opportunity to see the movie Gentleman's Agreement is what it's called. The Gentleman's Agreement in this case is essentially don't make waves. As long as we don't actually say it openly, it's subtle, it's not rude, it's not hateful, it's just discrimination. You should try to make time to watch this movie, A Gentleman's Agreement, or Gentleman's Agreement, with Gregory Peck. You can also look it up on imdb.com, internetmoviedatabase.com. Open lines, open forum, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Okay, another thing that came up just recently, I had ordered some light bulbs. Now, I'm going to try to make this interesting, but this is sort of a little techie stuff. Many, many years ago, people would complain about commercials being much louder than the programming. So especially late at night, you would have a television show on where you had to turn the volume all the way up to hear what they were saying, and all of a sudden this commercial would come out and you'd feel like your eardrums had been blown up. And when people complained, and at some point the FCC got involved, and the stations would say, hey, it's the same decibel level. We're not turning up the volume. And after some investigation and some work, what it turned out was it was true. They were not turning up the volume, but they were turning up the treble and turning down the bass. So it was much more piercing. It was perceived as louder. Now, if you go shopping for something like a dishwasher, dishwashers make a greater or lesser amount of noise, depending on how much insulation they have and the isolation of the motor and such. Now, when you shop for a dishwasher, one of the things that they will mention is decibels. Typically, a quiet dishwasher, I think, is something around 50 or 54 decibels. But when you shop for a dishwasher or, let's say, even for a bathroom vent fan, you'll also see that there's a measurement in something called sones. S-O-N-E-S. Sones is different from decibels. Decibels is absolute loudness. Sones is perceived loudness. So that's how they began to deal with this thing with commercials where, hey, the decibels are the same. We're just turning the treble all the way up. So now they have a measurement called sones. So you've got real sound, you've got perceived sound. And that's how that became a little bit more balanced. So I tell that story to come to this one. I recently bought some light bulbs. This is actually an important topic, okay? Egberto is laughing. Bob is going like, huh? No, this is really an important topic, and I'll tell you why. Incandescent light bulbs were sort of a known quantity. You had your 15, 25, 40, 60, 7,500 watt, whatever. When they started doing CFCs, compact fluorescent lights, CFLs, I guess they're called, back, I don't know, 20 years ago, they would put equivalencies because people didn't know how to use these CFLs, these compact fluorescent lights. So they would put equivalencies. So it's like this 15-watt bulb in a compact fluorescent is roughly comparable to a 60-watt incandescent. This 9-watt bulb is roughly comparable to a 40-watt incandescent. And that's kind of where we are now. So you've got packages of light bulbs where they have this equivalency. This 9 or whatever it is comparable to this. This other thing is comparable to that kind of incandescent. But now we have this new thing, LED bulbs. And what I'm beginning to realize is this equivalence has become fairly useless. And it's become fairly useless, in my opinion, probably because there is a lack of regulation. What is this equivalency? So you have real wattage. You have, I guess, equivalent wattage. But then you have actual light output. Now, they used to talk about that in terms of candles. The current measurement is something called lumens. Now, I have actually put a number of links on the blog post for tonight's show at thinkwingradio.com, thinkwing.org. And here's something interesting. So now you talk about equivalencies. In terms of what is considered equivalent, a 40-watt incandescent bulb is roughly equivalent to a 9 or 10-watt fluorescent. But that is about 600 lumens. Yeah, you can maybe go to 500 lumens and still kind of feel like it's somewhat an incandescent, a 40-watt incandescent. And frankly, from product to product, from brand to brand, there has always been some variation. The thing that brought this to mind, I was shopping for some candelabra bulbs, which I got to tell you, man, there is not a lot of selection in bulbs with a candelabra socket. And I found what I felt was a reasonable buy for some LEDs for a fan setup. And they were touted as being 40-watt equivalent. They were 2.5 watts. And I'm going to myself, from what I know of these things, it's like 2.5 watts, man, that's a really low wattage for a 40-watt equivalency. But I figured, hey, technology. Maybe they found a way to increase the efficiency. So I bought the bulbs. They were from Lowe's, mail order, special order. And to quote an old Jimmy Stewart movie, these weren't lights. These were darks. Mr. Hobbs takes a vacation. Great line. And these things put out 210 lumens. Now, remember, I just said that a 40-watt bulb, the equivalency is considered to be 600, maybe 500 lumens. And they had labeled this very clearly as a 40-watt equivalency with 210 lumens. And I have since been shopping. I returned those bulbs, needless to say. And I have since been shopping to find something I can use at a price I like. And what I'm finding is that these equivalencies no longer mean anything. They call any number of lumens they want, any kind of wattage equivalency they want. So I am now at the point where I think it is time for a federal rule. I think the federal rule needs to get away from these watt equivalencies and start to standardize lumens. So many lumens will equal so many watts. If they want to have fewer lumens, they're going to have to change the wattage accordingly. So, for example, if they want to have 375 lumens, they can no longer just say, hey, it's a 40-watt equivalency. No, that's actually a 25-watt equivalency. Why does this matter? It matters because when you buy these light bulbs, which are not cheap, I mean, even a compact fluorescent is $2 or $3 a pop. The incandescents, remember, have been outlawed. They're not supposed to be selling or making any more to import into the country. And essentially, this is, they say they're saving you money, but what they're doing is they're selling you a lesser product than you think you're buying. Now, that's a kind of fraud. So, you know, having come from decibels to zones to wattage equivalencies and all this stuff, all of this has to do with what you think you're getting versus what they are actually selling you, and that if there is not a standard, and standards are created by regulation, if there is not a standard, they can call anything they want anything they want. So these people that say, we don't want no stinking regulation because it holds back free enterprise and it stifles creativity and it costs jobs, you know what? It also keeps them from screwing you. So think about this the next time you go out and buy light bulbs. Light bulbs are no longer a cheap investment. If you go out and buy 10 light bulbs, this could be $30, $80, $120, literally, in that range, that big range. Pay attention to the lumens. And if you feel moved, you might write to your congressperson or your senator or even a state regulator and say, you know what, this is something that we need to look at for consumer, not so much consumer safety, but consumer fairness. There should be something that I can look at that I know exactly what I'm getting, and there shouldn't be something that says in big type, 60-watt equivalent, and then in tiny, tiny, tiny type, maybe on the back of the package, 300 lumens. So, that's that thing. Just needed to get that out. Now, this is open forum. You can talk about the movie Gentleman's Agreement, you can talk about wattage and lumens, or you can talk about anything else you want, frankly. The phone number is 713-526-5738. We are again in a situation where I do not have a screen, so I'm going to have to rely on Egberto and perhaps Bob, who's also sitting in, to help me out if someone calls, to let me know there's a caller and to let me know what the person's name is. And he's smiling and he's saying yes, but no. So I'm guessing that means, yes, he's going to tell me if there's a caller, but no, there aren't any. Is that correct, Bob? Okay, yes, I interpreted that correctly. I'm really terrible at mime, so I'm kind of grateful that I was able to figure that out. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I am Mike Koenig. My engineer cohort is Egberto Willis, who has his own show Thursdays at 3, Politics Done Right. And I've got Bob Kibitzing. That's not his last name, by the way. That's Bob, and he is Kibitzing. Okay, I was in College Station this past week, and I got to talking about a topic that I have actually thought quite a bit about, and it's a topic that interests me, concerns me, puzzles me, and there has been, I did a little research before I came in to talk about it. There apparently has been some studying of this, but I don't think there's been enough. And if there is, not tons of it has been published. And the difference is this. We have seen how badly the occupation turned out in Iraq and Afghanistan. Disastrous. I'm sorry, who's on line two? Bill. Okay, I'm just going to finish this little thing and then I'll get to Bill. It has interested me for the last several years. You know, at the end of the Second World War, the occupation of Germany and Italy and Japan went pretty smoothly. You know, there were some diehards, but there weren't any insurgencies. There weren't rebellions. You didn't have foreign fighters coming in. You didn't have underground cells, the equivalent of the French underground or the partisans in the Balkans. You didn't have those kinds of groups fighting us like they fought the German occupation. It went pretty smoothly. And within 10 years, all the countries that had been conquered had recognized governments, had become recognized independent nations again. Granted, within the Western orbit, but nonetheless, we're independent nations. And here's the interesting thing. You look back at history, and when you see the Iraq and Afghanistan experience, you realize that outcome was not guaranteed. There was no reason that anti-American, anti-British, anti-French Germans or diehard Japanese or fascist Italians, there is absolutely no reason why they would not have started to create insurgencies and resistance cells against the Allied occupation. But even though that was a problem, it was a minimal problem. It was resolved very quickly. And I think that there is a lot to be learned from this comparison. Why did the Allied occupation of Europe after the Second World War work so much better than the, quote, Allied or predominantly American occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan? Why did they turn out to be such a disaster? I think this is a really, really important, almost existential, politically existential question. Was it because there was a formal surrender and terms of surrender and people authorized to give a surrender? Because as far as I know, there was never actually an Iraqi surrender. As far as I know, there was never an actual Afghan surrender. Maybe that was a factor. Maybe the fact that we had invaded them with a real armed force, that we had really mobilized. We had a real war economy. And even though there was a lot of demobilization after the end of fighting, there was still a lot of mobilization. And maybe that had a factor to do with it. Maybe in the case of Germany, there was a denazification program, but we didn't dismantle everything. When you got down to local officials, if they had not been real Nazis, and I, you know, use the term advisedly, they were basically left to assist in civil order. It's all very, very interesting stuff. Anyhow, I just wanted to get that out because it's a topic that I think is really important. I've got some links to some long papers on my website, thinkwingradio.com, for today's show. But I would like to really talk about this. So now we're going to get to our caller. We do have open lines, 713-526-5738. Bill, I think you're on the air. Bill, how you doing?
Yeah. Hello.
Yes, are you here? Can you hear me?
I'm here.
Good deal. What's on your mind tonight?
Okay, the first thing, you were talking about the light bulbs.
Yes.
Here's one that you need to also consider. It's called synthetic blended motor oil.
Okay. Yeah. You switched gears on me there for a moment, and I'm still thinking lights, and then you go to motor oil, and it's like I had to do a mental transition. Okay. Blended synthetic motor oil. I got you. Go ahead.
Right. There's no standards for that. You can put two drops of synthetic oil into regular motor oil, and it becomes synthetic blended oil.
And that potentially can ruin your engine if you're assuming a certain lifespan for the use of that oil and it's not blended to a point where that's justifiable. What do they say that blended oil should get you, 5,000 to 7,000 miles?
It depends on the oil. I use synthetic that goes 15,000.
Yeah, but the blended synthetic, I think what I have learned recently is allegedly, and I get your point, but allegedly it's supposed to go instead of 3,000 or 4,000 miles, 5,000 to 7,000, maybe 8,000 miles.
Yeah, something like that.
So we're talking about you pay a little extra for a better oil, so you don't have to change your oil as often. But because there is no standard, you point out, for what constitutes a blended oil, if it doesn't have enough synthetic blended in, your engine is at risk, which is a big deal.
Yeah, it's a real big deal when you think that it could cost you a brand new engine.
Yeah. And, of course, there's also the safety aspects. If your engine fails at a bad time, you could end up in a multi-car accident or, you know, whatever. It's not a good thing when your engine seizes up. Okay, I didn't know that. But, again, that speaks to there is a place for government regulation.
Oh, yeah, we need to go back to standardization in this country.
I see regulation. I have a term that I call right regulated. You know, everything has a sweet spot. You can be over-regulated, you can be under-regulated. But I think that there is a point where you are right regulated. And one of those points is to have a floor that everyone understands is the playing field. I think that's one of the benefits of Obamacare, is it puts a floor on what you can sell as a health insurance plan. You can offer more, and then you can charge more for it, but everybody knows they're getting at least this.
Yeah.
And that's a real benefit of essential and correct regulation. And it actually should also benefit the businesses, because they know what they need to do to compete. Do you remember, in I think it was the 2010 elections, and the Republicans were going, "We have to end the uncertainty."
They don't want any risk either.
Yeah, but have they ended the uncertainty or have they enhanced it?
They enhanced
it? Absolutely.
It's just like with the stock market. They put a stop in if stocks start to fall. And then after a certain point, they shut the market down. Where they used to just let the market fall, and then it would fall so much, and then all of a sudden it would pick up, but they wouldn't shut the market down. They don't understand. You shut the market down, you're losing money.
Yeah, and of course, when you take away regulation, instead of helping business, what you do is simply create chaos.
Yeah, and that hurts business more than anything else.
Okay,
so,
Bill.
Also, on your deal on Iraq and Afghanistan,
yeah,
you were comparing to World War II.
Yeah.
Number one, we didn't totally wipe out all the buildings and everything. We left stuff standing, where in World War II, they came in and just massively bombed everything to the ground.
Well, that's true, but the question is it relevant to the question I raised?
Well, yeah. Well, it could be. It could be one of the, you know, parts of it.
It's a variable.
Like there was no formal surrender. And all of what you were talking about, each part has a, you know, a part into it of why, you know, we have the insurgents.
It's a topic that I will be coming back to. There are some really long papers, like 30, 40 pages a piece, and I don't want to read all of them, but I want to scan through them and see what points I can pick up. So this topic will come up again. I've got three other callers, and
okay.
I like to try to get everybody on, but I love the thing you said about the motor oil. I did not know that. It's interesting. I thank you for calling, and I hope you'll call back sometime. Take care, Bill. Okay, next up is Jerry. Jerry, I believe you're on the air. How you doing tonight? What's on your mind?
All right, I'm doing okay. Yeah, there's actually a branch of the government or a government agency called NIST, National Institutes for Standards and Technology, that's supposedly in charge of that stuff.
Has it been defunded by the Republicans? Because that would be my first guess.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
But anyway.
Is this something that's just kind of below their radar screen that they need to be pointed toward?
Maybe, I don't know.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
You know, it's just a thought. But anyway, I was going to say about modern warfare, the thing about it is that those were states going up against states.
But there was no declaration of war, which is why there was no technical surrender.
No. But what I'm saying is that you compared it to Germany and Japan. Germany and Japan declared war on the United States.
And we declared war back.
And we declared war back, right, and all that. But the thing about it is that basically, for one thing, that was a totally different war in some ways. For another, we did have a lot more guys on the ground. And basically, the political leadership in those countries pretty much just said, you know, it's game over.
Well, there's
we were running all around and everything, and, you know, you could shoot a few GIs, but it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't get you anything.
Well, I mean, there are a huge number of variables here in terms of different culture, undeclared versus declared war, the number of boots on the ground, how mobilized we were, what our national determination was, how big. I mean, there are a lot of variables, but the question I think still remains, what are the variables that made the difference between what was basically a smooth and trouble-free occupation and a totally disastrous occupation that essentially just set the stage for another war? Essentially, was the Iraq and Afghan occupation essentially the set us up for the Versailles Treaty, which then essentially set the groundwork for what became World War II? Did we basically do a Versailles at the end of the Afghan and Iraq wars?
No, basically, conflict has fundamentally changed in certain ways. You talk about World War II, where those were a couple of the last war, you know, that was a couple of the last go-arounds where we actually wound up wars that way. We actually had a formal peace and all that other stuff.
World War II was the last war with declarations of war. I think the last declaration of war,
but also with actual, you know, terms of peace and all that.
Right.
Plus, we demanded the total surrender of those societies.
Which, in the case of Japan,
sat there and said, and, you know, of course, when the vast majority of people throw down their weapons and sit there and go, okay, we're, you know, we'll do whatever, you know, we'll put ourselves under your authority or whatever, it's incredibly hard for just a handful of people holding out to really do much.
And yet they did in Iraq and Afghanistan. And again, the question becomes, what makes the difference?
Germany and Japan, you're really comparing two completely different things.
Well, I'm comparing success and failure.
Fundamentally, you think about it. What was the next war we fought? It was the Korean War.
Which was undeclared. Which was inconclusive.
Which was undeclared and inconclusive, and we're still sitting there right there on the DMZ.
Right.
And everything after, you know, what, 50, 60 years? So, so that's one thing. Conflict basically fundamentally changed. One of the things that you have is, you know, basically the U.S. military had this idea about, you know, that they were going to, like, totally dominate on the battlefield, and they managed to do that.
And they did, yeah.
But, you know, basically, you know, it was, you know, total battlefield dominance or whatever it was. It was a total dominance theory and everything. And they, you know, we had the electronics and all the other stuff to do that and enough manpower and all that to do all that. The problem is that nobody's going to fight us in a war like that from now on.
Well, I also think that strategically they had figured how they wanted to win the war and really did not have a good plan for what they were going to do afterward in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that what they wanted to do was occupy on the cheap. We didn't have a mobilized economy. You know, we didn't have a mobilized war.
I think that they thought somehow or another, I think they actually thought that somehow or another they'd be able to wrap things up in 2 or 3 years and go home and somehow or another, or for the most part, do that anyway. They might have to leave a few troops behind.
Yeah, the things would work out.
Nowhere near as many as they wound up having to leave over there. And, but basically the thing is that, you know, basically warfare's changed in some really fundamental ways, and the political part of it's changed quite a bit. Like you said, nobody declares war anymore.
Right. And that creates its own problems, apparently.
Nobody declares war anymore, and nobody, you know, very few people sit there and fight, you know, head-to-head wars anymore, battles and everything. We can win any kind of battle like that you want to name. Nobody's interested in doing that with us.
Hey, Jerry, I've got three other callers on the line. I appreciate your putting in your 2 cents, and you've made some good points.
Okay, yeah.
And I'll be looking forward to hearing from you again.
Okay, thanks.
Take care, Jerry. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm Mike Koenig, and Egberto Willis is working on engineering. He's got his show on Thursdays at 3. And the next caller is Sam. Sam, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Hey, pretty good. How you doing, Mike?
Okay, thanks.
All right. I just like to I really love the points you brought up because, I mean, they're extremely important points, and they kind of more or less go hand in hand. The thing about the light bulbs is it's crazy to me because if you stop for a second and you think about it, you're having a reading that's telling you what you perceive. Now, what you perceive is what you perceive. I mean, it's entirely relative. When you have an institution telling you how you perceive things, I mean, that's, to me, it just seems kind of, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at all to me.
Well,
but,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, there's a need for regulation, absolutely. And I think a lot of people are scared of regulation because they're afraid of people telling them what to perceive.
They've been made afraid of reasonable regulation.
Yes, I agree 100% on that. And the problem is that we're so afraid of reasonable regulation, we end up getting the bad kind.
Well, we end up getting no regulation or minimal regulation and ineffective regulation.
Yeah.
And unenforced regulation.
Exactly. And I think that standards need to be standards. There doesn't need to be a standard to maintain a standard. We need to just have parsimony.
Parsimony. I don't know that I've heard that word, and I don't know that I've heard it applied that way. Would you like to define for me?
Sure. So the way I understand parsimony is the easiest and simplest way to get things done most effectively. So, I mean, efficiency, essentially. So a regulation on a regulation is not very efficient when you can get those things done with one regulation.
Right. And that comes back to the term of being right regulated as opposed to over or under regulated.
Exactly. And the whole war question on why it was a, you know, successful occupation as opposed to an unsuccessful occupation, I think a lot of it has to do with the motives, obviously. Now, I guess I don't want to talk too much about it, but if you go back and you look at, you know, British or Russian imperialism of China, a lot of that was made easy due to opium and getting a lot of the population, you know, strung out and high on opium. And I think a lot of the conflict in the Middle East has a lot to do with the opium triangle. And, you know, they're bringing it back to our country because it makes it easier for, you know, them to tell us what to perceive.
Well, I think it's strictly a fundraising aspect. You know, we're a customer, they're a provider, it funds their activities. But when you talk about the opium trade in China, yes, that is part of it. And it's kind of ironic that in the 1800s, the British actually fought a war for the right to send opium to China. China was trying to prevent them from sending in opium. So, I mean, that by itself is interesting. But I think an important consideration here is when the colonial powers carved out their spheres of influence, there was a Chinese government, weak as it was. It was a recognized central government that had perceptually the right and the power to make treaties. Now, you can argue, were they unequal treaties? Were they lawful treaties? Did they sign them with a gun to their heads, which makes them not effective? But there was a central government that said, okay, you know, the United States can have this area, and Britain and France can have those areas, and Portugal can have Goa, and those sorts of things. And I think that's an important difference between the circumstance that we had in Iraq and Afghanistan, where there was nobody to deal with. And there was no one to tell the population, okay, we're done fighting, and now we're going to put the country back together. There really wasn't a central power to say that, in my opinion.
My point didn't come across right.
Okay.
I guess it's because it's a little far-fetched. But, I think that a lot of what we're doing over there has a lot to do with opium trade bringing back to our own country.
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
I think where we disagree is, you know, that you see it as a form of mind manipulation, whereas I just see it as a straight business transaction. They sell us opium, they get money to fund their military activities.
Right. Okay, so then I guess my next point would be, I agree with you on that. Possibly the reason it's different then is that there are more, I mean, there's always going to be business motives, but possibly the motives of the people who surrendered were different back during World War II. I mean, Japan, they you know, surrendered without condition.
Well, no, that isn't true. That was the line that was sold to the populations of the Allied powers. Germany surrendered unconditionally. Essentially, we had a blank slate. The Japanese negotiated the survival of the emperor.
Okay.
And they also, and also MacArthur, used the existing levers of power in Japan to run the occupation, which is why there is such an enormous difference between how post-war Japan sees their role in the war and how post-war Germany sees their role. Post-war Germany was completely denazified. I don't know what the equivalent term would be for Imperial Japan, but it wasn't.
So you're saying possibly some of the effectiveness would be through using established governments as opposed to building up our own, or...
I think that wise use of existing power structures, wise use, makes the difference. But how you use what levers exist make a very big difference in terms of outcomes. And again, the comparison I always use is post-war Germany versus post-war Japan.
Right.
Post-war
right.
Germany is well integrated into democratic Europe right now, whereas Japan is widely despised and distrusted by pretty much everybody in East and South Asia, mostly East Asia. My mother-in-law actually, as a child, was sort of taken prisoner slash adopted by a Japanese officer when she was like 7 or 8 years old. She's got stories to tell. He actually treated her reasonably well when they were alone, but when other Japanese officers were present, he had to treat her like a servant.
Wow.
Because otherwise he would be humiliated in their eyes. Why are you treating this inferior Chinese child well when she's conquered? I mean, there's a lot here to know and to think about.
Absolutely. That's a great, great conversation, great point. And really quickly before I jump off the line, I think there is a very powerful and dignified act in surrendering. I think to do so is demonstrating, you know, a willingness for peace, and I think that's very important. And I think since even when we, you know, when we've come over. The Europeans came over to the Americas. I mean, it was always about, I mean, to obtain the resources of the land and to get what you want. You know, quid pro quo is how, you know, economy is supposed to work, trade. But it's for a long time, it's always been quid pro nothing. Give me this or else. And the only way to do that is to kill the people that have. And I mean, you smallpox, opium, whatever have you. I think a lot of the difference in the institutions that are today and the governments that are today post-war have a lot to do with the people who were defeated and surrendered and their mentality and how they were going to deal with the new coming changes.
One last point.
Yeah, sir.
I'm just going to say before I let you go, one last point because it's relevant to what we've been saying. If you remember Churchill's famous speech, we will never surrender. We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them in the cities. We will fight them in the hills. That's the difference between a country surrendering and a country being conquered but not defeated. So that I think, very clearly defines the difference between how Germany might have taken over Britain versus how the Allies conquered Germany and Japan and how they didn't do such a great job in Iraq and Afghanistan. Okay, I'm going to let you go. I got a couple other callers. I appreciate the conversation. I hope you'll call back. Okay, take care. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. Okay, Robert's up next. This is 90.1 FM Houston. And Robert, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Good. Just a couple of quick points.
Sure.
One is that for these consumer issues, if all of your listeners would write a short note to the Federal Trade Commission and complain about it, that would actually initiate some rulemaking analysis. And that's the only way you get anything like that done. The Obama administration is using rulemaking like that, and you know, if they get a flood of complaints, they actually will initiate it because it's the only way they can get anything done.
That's,
the second point is,
I'm sorry, I'm just going to insert here. Would something like that, do you know offhand, would it be like FTC.gov and people could send them email?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You can get actually get the complaint forms there.
Great.
And the other thing is the jobs that they're talking about losing are jobs in China.
Yeah.
So all of those people who are in favor of nuking China ought to be in favor of harsh regulation in the United States. Because most of the products that we have any kind of problem with come from China. So if only they would listen to that and consider that regulation here actually protects us and raises the standard of living for whatever workers are required to make products more safe.
Essentially,
so it's a ridiculous argument.
We've had H. Ross Perot's giant sucking sound, but didn't go to Mexico, it went to Asia.
And in Asia, they don't care whether it kills you and the people who build it, so long as you buy it.
China has a very interesting system. It's kind of a blended socialist, authoritarian, capitalist system. And having been to China and spoken to Chinese, my perception is you can get away. They have rules, nominally. But in China, you can pretty much get away with anything with two exceptions. You must not contest or embarrass the Chinese Communist Party, and you must not embarrass the nation of China. If you don't do either of those two things, you can get away with a lot.
And many of these companies are owned by people actually from other countries. They've just gone to China and have provided this professional expertise and investment. So many of them are from other countries, and really the only reason they would follow any Chinese regulation is their fear of reprisal in China, which is very low so long as they do things that are just misrepresentative or deceitful or steal trade secrets or steal patents. As long as they're doing that sort of thing, they're fine.
You know, my wife once explained that to me. Apparently, it goes back a long way in Chinese culture. They do not have the concept of something like a patent, which is why everything in China is trade secrets. Among Chinese, everything is trade secrets. One of the reasons that the West has such a problem, as I understand it, trying to get the Chinese to enforce and even grasp the concept of licensing intellectual property rights, is it really doesn't exist in the Chinese culture. It's an alien transplant, and I don't think they entirely understand why it's so important to us. When something is out there, it's out there. That's their attitude. And it doesn't make them evil. This is just their culture. This is how things have always worked for them. So it's really hard to get them to accept this Western concept of intellectual property rights and royalties and licensing and those sorts of things. Are you gone?
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate the call.
Okay, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM. On engineering, I've got Bob on my phone lines, and I've got Egberto Willis on the control board, and of course he's got his own show Thursdays, 3 p.m. Politics Done Right, and here we just do all kinds of stuff. Okay, I've got Gary on the line. By the way, we will have some open phone lines, and we'll have a little time left. If you want to call in, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Gary, I believe you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
All right. Did you say your wife was Chinese?
My wife was born in mainland China, in the People's Republic. She came to North America in like 1990 or 1991.
All right. Well, because my hero in the world is Lao Tzu.
I'm sorry, who?
Lao Tzu, as you would say.
Oh, the military?
No, Lao Tzu, Taoism.
Ah.
The Tao Te Ching. You've never heard of Taoism?
I have heard of it. I really don't know anything about it, I must admit.
He was the enemy of Confucius. I called to tell you that I think you're like one of those missing the forest for the trees kind of guy here.
Okay. Show me the forest.
You're talking about the difference between the victories in World War II against the Germans and the Japanese and the failures in... I guess it's half a war, World War Two and a half, in Iraq and Afghanistan, elsewhere, and you know you're comparing apples to oranges. Now, bear with me. Germans were Germans were Germans. That's why they hated the gypsies. That's why they hated the Jews. They hated these interlopers that came to their country because they were Germans. Japanese were Japanese. They were all faithful and loyal to the 18 tribes in every country, and they all hated
you. Got to watch that, Gary, because now Berto is going
to... Like Jeff Bird did.
Hold on a second. I got to tell you, Egberto now is going to have to fill out a form.
I'll fill it out. Now, look, here's the situation. It's a different, you don't wear, you take water into the desert and you wear camouflage in the jungle. We're totally different situations here. We're talking about, you know, the Middle East with all the tribes and all the disagreements and all the animosity compared to Europeans who had 300-400 years to consolidate. It's a tribalism thing.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. And, of course, what you're saying is part of the reason I pose the question. But I think that part of it, aside from your point that there's tribal loyalty more than there's any loyalty to what they perceive as a state of which they are a part, I think that given that, among other things, I just don't think there was adequate planning for how they were going to reconstruct the nations that they had conquered. I just don't think they gave enough planning to that.
Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein and Egypt, all these countries, they had these dictators, and they were evil and anti-democratic and oppressive.
But Libya and Libya and Egypt are totally different things. We didn't go to war with them. We didn't invade them. We didn't conquer them. We didn't then try to nation build them. What we did was intervene in a civil war, which our objective was basically to minimize human slaughter. I'm talking about very specific things, wars we went into, countries we occupied, and nations that it was our obligation and intent to rebuild in something like our image, like we did with Germany and Japan.
But there was a difference in the culture.
I'm not saying no. But that is part of the question. Is it a matter of culture? Was it a matter of manpower? Was it a matter of planning? Was it a matter of political strategy and tactics in terms of what we did in those countries, what levers of power we pulled, what parts of the government and the administration we preserved versus what we dismantled? I mean, all of that. You're right. I mean, the tribalism is a big issue, and the lack of feeling part of a state is a big issue. But if there had been a central government that actually surrendered and actually called on people to lay down their arms or at least go back to their barracks, would that have made a difference with enough of the people in that country that it would have changed the ultimate outcome of the occupation? If there had been a government to actually surrender to terms and actually stay in existence long enough to say, and this is the transition, and this is how things are going to go, as opposed to collapse and anarchy, which is what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan.
All right. Well, I understand.
And was a declaration of war or lack thereof one of the key pieces? In the absence of a lack of a declaration of war, can you have an actual peace treaty? And
you're
who would sign it?
Comparing apples to oranges?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And why? Why? Why?
Why is Boko Haram destroying Nigeria? What's happening in England? They're protesting because they don't make enough money.
Okay, but again,
there are tribal issues, and that's why dictators had their function, and Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi and all these. And
you really have to watch the language, Gary, or I'm going to have to let you go.
One last thing. So, you know, we all got along and we got together, but this isn't going to happen with the Shias and the Sunnis and the Kurds. You know, there are animosities there that are historical, and it took a dictator to keep them together, and that's a different culture. And China is a different culture, and Japan is a different culture, but we are trying to measure their cultures by our culture. We're looking at the world through rose-colored glasses here.
Okay, Gary, I've got...
Thank you very much for bearing with me. Good night.
Likewise, I'm sure. Take care. Just watch the language there, Gary, please.
A little slip. I did it to Berg.
Twice. You did it twice tonight. Okay. Thanks for calling. You know I always appreciate it. All right. I've got June on the line. You're on the air now, I believe. How are you doing tonight?
Fine. Thanks, Mike. How are you doing?
Okay. Thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm listening to all these people talking, and I realize that half of these people are inebriated. And it's
I don't think that that's the case.
Well, man, but some people are not making correct sense or logic. And all I'm trying to say is that, you know, your callers are very keen and perspective, and I think that's a great thing. But I just want to say to these inebriated listeners, please don't call in. That's all I'm saying.
I have to say, June, as a call-in talk show host, please call in. otherwise, I just sit here and pontificate.
When you're not making any sense, you should not infect other people with your illogical logic, and you know you think you're smart, but you're not.
Okay, here's my philosophy on this.
Yes, sir.
First of all, the people that call in, whatever you think of their knowledge level or their reasoning capability or style, the fact is that these are ideas that are out there. These are opinions that are out there. If they don't call in and offer them to me and to our listeners, nobody gets to discuss them. Nobody gets to have an opinion about them. They don't get to air them. I don't get to talk counterpoints to them. And in the absence of discussion, nothing ever changes. So that's point number one.
Correct.
Point number two is... without callers, this would be a very boring show.
I disagree. You talk very well, and dialogue between you and Egberto is very interesting. And sometimes I rather hear that instead of some people.
But now think of the fact that you're calling me right now, and we are having this discussion right now. And part of this discussion, the big part of this discussion, is why do we have a call-in talk show? KPFT is part of Pacifica. The mission is an educational mission. I like to think that part of what I do, I try to do it in as entertaining a way as I can.
And you do a great job, Mike.
But part of what I try to do is to have people think of things in new ways, maybe to have information they didn't have, even if it's to look it up and challenge me and tell me maybe I'm wrong. So this is all about education and information.
And I enjoy that, too.
Okay. I appreciate that, June. I got one more person, and I try to make it a policy to get everybody on that calls if I can.
Thank you very much. And also reiterate, if you're drunk, don't call.
don't drink and call. Okay. We've got that. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. I'm sorry. Who's on now?
Bobby.
Bobby, you're on the air, and we got about 3 minutes. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, good. I kind of got to the end of it. I've been... working. I came out of a school where I was working, and now I'm driving down the freeway. And I heard a guy, and you were talking about tribalism and all kinds of things about cultures and stuff.
Yeah, we
and
get deep.
I don't know what your subject was much, but I do know that tribalism and warlords are alive and healthy right here. Have you ever heard of the South? You know? And, every county in the South, and everywhere in the country, probably everywhere, they have people who are in power in different cities and counties. And look at the court, county judge in Harris County. Look at all these things are like little tribal warlord enclaves that are run by people in sequence, the difference being that democratic ones tend to not be so harsh, and the ones that are dictators, which the United States often supports in foreign countries are pretty harsh and hard to get rid of.
Well, I think what's kind of interesting, I personally believe that clannishness, tribalism, warlords or strongmen, I think that that is part of the human condition. I think that there is a constant dynamic tension between organization and entropy, politically speaking. I think that, there's always this push to devolve power to smaller and smaller units, while there's also this drive to try to organize things into larger and larger units, and there's always this dynamic tension. But I think you're right, and now I've got music in my ear, which means I have to get ready to go. You got any last words before I hang up on you?
No, other than I just wish we could get these Southern, these Dixiecrats turned Republican, the wolves in sheep's clothing that are now real wolves, I wish they would behave themselves and start being Democrats.
Well, I'll tell you what, next week when I do my show, if you call in early, we can talk about that topic at length. I think that'd be fun.
Well, thanks.
All right. You take care. Have a great night. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. My compatriot here is Egberto Willis, who's got his own show Thursdays at 3, Politics Done Right. Bob has been kibitzing on the phone. We've all had a fun time. Thank you all for calling, and I'll look forward to speaking with you again next week. And go to my website, thinkwingradio.org. Take care.
Patel, Vice Chair of the KPFT Local Station Board.
And this is Duane Lark, Chair of the Local Station Board.
In fact, this announcement is about a vacancy on the Local Station Board.
And V, I'm very excited about the opportunity to fill this vacancy on the board. And this is a great opportunity for us to increase the diversity on the board.
I agree. Women, people under 40, and people of color are currently underrepresented on the board.
Well, now that we have them interested, let's tell them how to apply.
Well, you must be a member in good standing. Your application should consist of a short bio, your qualifications to serve on the board, as well as ideas to assist the board in accomplishing its duties.
Submit your completed application to lsb@kpft.org. That's lsb@kpft.org. Remember, the deadline for applications is July 8th, 2015, 5 p.m.
For more information about the LSB, go to kpft.org.
KPFT Houston.
You can make a difference by donating something, whether it's moving or not. An old car, RV, motorcycle, tractor, or boat. To KPFT's vehicle donation program, whether we played your favorite song or helped you discover your new favorites, you listen because you enjoy KPFT's unique mix of sounds. Just call 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visit kpft.org to help now. Your tax-deductible donation before the new year gets you a KPFT membership and makes such a difference at a station that is the heart and soul of our community. So, just move to the phone and call 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visit kpft.org. And we'll make it easy to donate to the nonprofit radio station that you love. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.